today, the country where getting through one pack of cigarettes a day would make you a light smoker.
I've been spending a lot of time in Jordan this year, and basically everywhere you go, one thing that's very striking is that people are always smoking. I mean, cigarettes here are just everywhere.
Okay, let's go ahead.
I remember a few months ago, I was doing one of the really great tourist attractions here, which is something called Wadi Mujib. It's like a hike through through water, like over kind of rocks, leading towards this really gorgeous waterfall.
Watch out.
And you get there and you're kind of completely exhausted and completely soaked. And I remember I was sitting there with some friends at this waterfall, and at one point we looked at each other and we were like, can you smell smoke? Like, is someone smoking up here? And we just couldn't believe how somebody was able to get cigarettes into that place. And we looked around and loads of people were smoking, and it turns out they put cigarettes and a lighter into a water bottle, and they kind of carried that with them through this hike. And it struck me that people here, you know, go to extraordinary lengths to have a cigarette.
Come on, you can do it!
And I looked into this a little more, and I kept seeing these, small anecdotes. Things like, for example, you know, the football team here, the national football team, was fined at the Asian Cup in Australia a few years ago for smoking in the change rooms. The fact that in Parliament they tried to ban smoking in the actual chamber, but had to reverse that apparently because they couldn't get quorum for votes because everyone was outside having a cigarette. And so I thought, okay, this is an interesting kind of colour story about, you know, what life is like in this place where smoking rates are still, you know, extraordinarily high. And so I pitched that, and it was commissioned, and I kind of set about trying to research what I thought would be a kind of lighter story, you know, like full of these kinds of, you know, funnier kind of anecdotes, a kind of slice of life somewhere else in the world.
In fact, what The Guardian's international correspondent Michael Safi ended up writing was much more than a colour piece or a slice of life. Instead, it became an investigation that would uncover claims of widespread interference in government policy by Big Tobacco in a country where 2 out of 3 men smoke every day. Now public health experts are warning that Jordan is headed for a public health catastrophe. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how did Jordan end up with the highest smoking rate in the world? Okay, so you know smoking is prolific in Jordan. You can see it all around you. But were you able to put numbers on that? Were you able to find out just how widespread it is?
Well, I mean, I started to have conversations with people who monitor this kind of thing. And they kept saying that for years, Jordan's been ranked number 2 in the world for tobacco consumption. But they were saying that there's, you know, a recent survey, and actually it's shown that Jordan is now number 1, that it's surpassed Indonesia. And people kept pointing me towards this particular doctor who is considered a kind of expert on the topic. His name is Dr. Feras Hawari. And so I set out to the King Hussein Cancer Center.
King Hussein Cancer Center.
The country's kind of leading cancer research and treatment facility.
One of the most prominent comprehensive cancer centres in the Middle East that treats both adults and children, all under one roof.
So the centre runs a clinic for people who want to quit smoking. And he told me that one of the things that they advise people who are trying to quit is that they need to start being patient with their kids after they stop smoking in the house.
Those kids are most likely nicotine dependent almost after birth. Mm-hmm. The child, from every 4 cigarettes that are smoked, the child has smoked 1. So imagine having those kids, those infants, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months old, growing in that environment. So we actually now advise our patients that if they have young children at home, that they need to be patient with them, specifically the first 3 weeks when their parents are quitting smoking. Because we are controlling those parents with medications, but the kids are going through withdrawal because we don't have them on medication.
They've been exposed to so much that they can be 7 or 8 years old, but actually addicted to smoking. And so while...
Oh my God.
Yeah, right. Kids are going cold turkey. And so for a few weeks at least, they're going to be struggling even more than their parents. And I mean, I was just dumbfounded by that.
And when we test these kids, if you test somebody who lives in a significantly polluted environment with smoking, you'll find that they have carbon monoxide levels in their breath that is almost equivalent to a smoker.
Wow. Wow.
That is astonishing. How much are individuals smoking for their children to become nicotine addicts?
Well, one of the points he made to me was that in Jordan, people who smoke a pack a day are considered actually light smokers. And surveys show that the average Jordanian man smokes 23 cigarettes a day, so more than a pack a day.
It's not just the number of smokers, but actually the amount of smoking that is happening right now.
Here?
Yeah.
So you think here it's not just the number of people, but people are smoking more?
We're ranked number one in the world, per capita.
That number is absolutely astonishing when you consider that a number of people won't smoke at all. So if your average is that high, some people must be smoking a huge amount. And do we know what they are smoking? Are we talking about cigarettes here?
Yeah, so he said that, you know, they treat people in their clinic who smoke 5, 6, 7 packs of cigarettes a day, but also cigars, shisha, you know, those water pipes that have become, you know, extremely popular and are a gateway for a lot of women in particular to begin smoking.
For your information, smoking water pipe or ergeta for 45 minutes is equivalent to smoking, on average, 3 packs of cigarettes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And so we have people here that would smoke 8 heads a day.
Wow.
Has it always been the case that Jordan is like this, that it's a country that smokes more than almost anywhere else on earth?
No, not really. If you look at surveys, they show that while smoking rates around the world have declined, actually in Jordan they've increased by something like 40% over the past 13 years. So this is something that is growing sharply worse here, even while it's improving in many other places. And when I asked Dr. Hawari why that might be, he said something that really intrigued me, which was that Jordan has seen really significant increases in the influence of big tobacco companies here. So they've opened up headquarters, factories, and he said that there's this perception that they have a lot of sway over policy here and how it's implemented.
Jordan is declared, we are ranked 2nd after Japan in terms of the influence of the tobacco industry in our country.
And I thought, you know, that's interesting. That's something for me to look into. So I started to look at who are the people who are collecting information in this space. And it turns out that there are a lot of small NGOs that have sprung up in the last few years. They were mostly run by women, most of them out of their homes. I mean, these were pretty small entities. They were kind of Davids against what they perceived to be the kind of Goliaths of these big tobacco industries. And what they did was point me to a lot of stuff that was actually public record. So things like newspaper stories, which would be reporting the fact that Philip Morris, for example, had refurbished 10 schools in the area around where its headquarters are in Jordan, that they were buying school bags for kids, they were equipping children with stationery for school, they were running these like career training events for young people. And they pointed me to the social media feeds of the Prime Minister of the country, which featured last year a short clip of the regional manager of Philip Morris actually talking up his company's contribution to Jordan.
طبعا فيليب موريس تتواجد في الأردن بالمصنع الوحيد في المنطقة والوطن العربي المملوك تماما من فيليب موريس.
Talking about how they pay lots of money in taxes, they employ loads of people, and that's still up on those feeds. I mean, you can go to YouTube and actually watch that interview.
احنا ثاني خلينا نحكي دافع ضرائب في الأردن مورد للخزينة.
That is amazing. Can you imagine if Boris Johnson posted the chief executive of a massive tobacco company talking about what a great investment they were in the country?
Right. I mean, it's something that's hard to imagine. And that was my experience looking into a lot of this story. It felt like the messages we've received about big tobacco in a place like the UK are not universal. In many places, the companies are not regarded with the same skepticism as they are in the UK or in other places.
What you've set out looks like an extraordinary lobbying effort. It's not an obvious fit that Big Tobacco would be interested in schooling, for example. Why are they pouring money into these things?
Well, they argue that this is in line with their corporate social responsibilities. They say that they're responsible corporate citizens, that they care about the societies in which they operate, in which they sell their products. And, you know, part of that social conscience they have is giving something back. So it's paying for schools, helping to train young people, you know, funding sports. They cast it as evidence of the fact that they do care about the places where they operate. But of course, if you ask public health advocates, they say it's a way of casting themselves as a positive influence on a country, rather than as people selling a product that has been proven to be extremely harmful. I mean, that is a huge contributor to cancers, heart disease, and other health problems.
What the NGOs were showing Michael was fascinating, but they hinted that there was more to this story of tobacco industry lobbying. One source from the Jordanian Health Ministry even suggested the companies interfered with government policy. But everyone was nervous and would only speak on the condition of anonymity, apart from one exception.
The people I spoke to kept pointing to one person who they felt like had the platform to be able to talk about this. And it was a member of the Jordanian royal family, Princess Dina Mired. And they said, you know, she's spent her lifetime lobbying for anti-cancer causes, fighting big tobacco. And if there's anyone who would be able to talk about this openly, it was her. I mean, it was striking that how far up the ladder you had to go to find someone who would be willing to go on the record. You literally had to go to a member of the royal family. But I should say that she was very clear about the fact that she wasn't speaking for the royal family. She was speaking as a kind of lifelong anti-cancer advocate.
So tell me about Princess Dina. Who is she and where did you meet her?
So one day I got a text from someone identifying themselves as the personal assistant of Princess Dina, and they said that they'd heard that I'd been looking into this issue, and that if I was interested, I should come to this 5-star hotel in Amman, where the princess would be one afternoon, and we could, you know, maybe discuss this. And so I walked into this 5-star hotel, and, you know, lots of marble and like very fancy furniture and that kind of lounge music in the background. And I was kind of rehearsing in my head, you know, Your Highness, Your Royal Highness, Your Majesty, trying to figure out how you address a princess, because I'd never met one before. And I walked into the dining room, and she was sitting there kind of holding court, you know, talking to the people around her. She made some room for me, and we sat down and had a chat about what was going on.
Yes. Hello, Michael. Perfect. Yeah. Okay.
What did she tell you?
So she said that for many years she had been in Geneva working for the Union for International Cancer Control, and in that job trying to fight big tobacco around the world. And then a few years ago she returned to Jordan and said that she was shocked by what she found there. She found that In fact, these companies had made deep inroads into her home country, that the fight had actually kind of come home for her.
Big Tobacco has arrived in Jordan a couple of years back, and they really hold the court, yeah, here.
I'm really interested in the fact that she was the only person willing to go on the record. Was there information that she gave you that took the story on?
Yes, she had heard that there were a series of meetings being held last year to determine regulations for e-cigarettes and for heated tobacco products. And so these are both products in which big tobacco industries are heavily invested. And she'd heard a rumor that lobbyists from these companies would actually be involved in these discussions over how the products should be regulated. And so she lobbied people to say, well, we should also be allowed to go. Over the course of about 6 months last year, they attended six or seven of these sessions. And she said that, you know, what took place around this table really, really shocked her.
They were a very aggressive bunch and really like bullies. They were really like bullies. And
she said that she found herself debating lobbyists from Big Tobacco over things that she felt were foregone conclusions. So over the harmfulness of these products, over things like pictorial warnings.
You know, and they argued against every single standard. They say, oh, prove that we are not safe. Prove it. And actually we did. Despite all of our efforts, and we wrote letters and we wrote reports to the Prime Ministry, we did everything that we can and failed miserably. They didn't take one single recommendation from us.
Now, Philip Morris disputes this version of events. So they're saying that they weren't sitting there trying to argue down all the standards. They were just pushing an alternate set of standards. But the anti-smoking advocates, including Princess Dina, who were in this meeting, found it a really frustrating process.
We did. There was a point that, you know, when it became very clear that they are wasting our time, we actually all walked out as a protest. And nothing happened. They continued.
Basically, what she felt is that tobacco company lobbyists were being given the opportunity to shape the regulation of their own products in Jordan.
Just to be clear, what is wrong with the idea of tobacco companies being present at these meetings? They would argue that if their product is going to be subjected to stricter regulations, they should be able to make their case against this in some way.
Well, I think the norm that has been adopted in many places around the world is that this is not really a kind of equal debate. This isn't the kind of debate over tax rates, for example, where, you know, one group wants them higher, one group wants them lower, and you kind of come to a compromise. Like, this is one group selling a deadly addictive product versus another group that's trying to save lives, you know, and these are not two equal sides, and that the only way to ensure that you govern these things properly is you kind of give more weight to the public health side rather than treating it like a debate between equals. You know, that's the norm that's been adopted. And the princess pointed me to an international anti-tobacco treaty that Jordan has actually signed up to, which calls on countries to try to prevent any interference by tobacco companies on their policies.
Campaigners say the presence of representatives for the tobacco companies at those meetings is contrary to those international agreements. The companies themselves disagree, saying it is normal practice and the regulations do not prohibit all communication between government and tobacco companies. Coming up, Michael finds a whistleblower with a stash of documents. So at this point in the investigation, Michael, you have a number of activists telling you that they believe there's been widespread interference in policymaking by tobacco companies. But presumably you want documentation to back all of this up. What did you do next?
What I needed was, I needed proof. Eventually I was given the contacts for a source who's asked me not to kind of give too much information about them. But for a reporter, this person was a kind of, it was like Christmas morning. I mean, they were the kind of person who keeps receipts, who painstakingly archives documents, who makes sure that they save every email, every correspondence, anything that they get given.
This guy sounds like a dream for a journalist. What did he show you?
Well, he was able to show me something like 15 years of databases detailing all the way the tobacco companies had been interacting with the Jordanian government. And this was really, really, really rich stuff. So, I mean, for example, these meetings that we've been talking about, they were able to actually show me minutes from the meetings. So here was finally this really hard proof that these companies had managed to attend these meetings. They were able to show me emails detailing apparent conflicts of interest.
What kinds of conflicts of interest?
Well, there are a couple of examples. One is that there are a number of MPs who are said to own cafes, restaurants, places where there is some economic interest in allowing smoking because the logic goes that it helps to bring in customers. There was also a really interesting example of a senior member of a major public health group who actually recused themselves from any anti-smoking work after a family member took a job as a lobbyist for a big tobacco company. And that helped to paint a picture for me of how difficult it is to properly regulate tobacco in Jordan.
Michael, so far you've told me a story about big corporations trying to exert influence over society in Jordan, ultimately to make more profit from selling tobacco and doing a pretty good job of it. As you've said, it's now overtaken Indonesia to be the leading country in the world when it comes to smoking rates. But the other side of the coin is the impact this is actually having on people's lives and their health in particular. How does that look when you zoom in? What sort of effect is this smoking epidemic having on the population of Jordan?
One of the things that Dr. Hawari said to me was that Jordan has a very young population. It's like 3/4 of the country is under the age of 30. And smoking rates among young people are really high. So, I mean, the surveys show that something like 45% of people under 15 have at least tried some form of tobacco. And he described that as a ticking time bomb because smoking-related illnesses like cancer, like heart disease, respiratory illnesses, they usually begin to manifest around the age of 40. Now, most of these young Jordanians will reach the age of 40 in about 10 years, so 2030. And he says he worries that if already cancer rates are much higher than they should be, within a decade, it might lead to a kind of meltdown. Like, he wasn't sure that the health system could cope with so many people reaching this dangerous age at the same time.
And that's the situation for people who smoke. But you've already told me that children of smokers are taking in so much secondhand smoke that it's damaging their health. Do we know how deadly this epidemic is for the Jordanians who are not smoking?
I was introduced to a woman named Rida Madada.
Okay, I'm just going to put this here so it captures your voice. Okay. And if you could maybe count to 10, we can see the levels on. Is it بتعدي على 10?
Yes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
She is an asthmatic. She's very, very sensitive to smoke. And living her daily life in a country where so many people are smokers is really difficult. So she worked for the government for 14 years, but had to actually take indefinite leave in January because she just couldn't cope with it anymore.
Everyone is smoking. Everyone, like everyone.
Yeah.
Clouds everywhere. They smoke all the time on their desks, in the hallways, in the bathrooms. And even the one who's smoking vape, they smoke vape from 8 to 3. And they bring two. In case of the battery, they bring two with them on their pockets.
She used to go and try and work from her car to get away with it. She would find that her eyes would burn, her lungs would burn. She would really, really struggle just to get through the day.
I can't. I'm so tired. Red, really red eyes. Like fire in my nose, in my chest. Like really fire. So after that, I couldn't go to work anymore. I can't.
And Ruba told me that she went and spoke to her managers and said, listen, can you put me in a different office? Can you put me in a different agency, one in which I might be able to avoid people smoking? And they said, like, actually, we can't. I mean, we can't really guarantee that if we put you somewhere, you know, they won't have a change of management and the new manager will decide they don't mind smoking in the office. And I should mention that she works for the government, so officially smoking is banned in every government building in the country. But in reality, it just comes down to what the person running the office thinks.
So, do you have any plan for how you can return to work anytime soon?
There's no hope to come back to work because I couldn't. Yani, now smoking is there. I can't.
That's so sad.
And she said that this extended to her whole life. I mean, we met at a cafe and I could kind of see her eyeing off the people around us who were lighting up cigarettes. We, you know, we kind of had to try and pick a place where we thought people wouldn't be smoking too much. And she said this was more or less her life. I mean, in winter when you can't even sit outside because it's so cold, she really struggles to leave the house.
So I can't take even my girls with me to a cafeteria or any place. So in winter, basically, we were isolated in the house because we can't go outside.
Almost like a lockdown.
Yeah, it's a lockdown. So it was like a preparation for COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really lockdown for me because I can't go anywhere, anywhere.
You began this, Michael, by pitching a essentially colour piece about smoking in Jordan, and you've ended up going through a long and detailed investigation that has had some pretty shocking results. What do you take away from this story?
So what an industry analyst said to me was that the point of a story like Jordan's is that big tobacco, while in a place like the UK, they'll say they admit their products are harmful, that they're committed to trying to reduce the amount of smoking in society, that in places where they can get away with influencing, with sponsoring, with advertising, they'll continue to do that. And so it's the other side of the success story that we tell about smoking rates in the developed world, which are falling. But that means that now the majority of the world's smokers are actually in lower and middle income countries. And, you know, we've been talking about Jordan, but some people suggested that Jordan might not actually have the worst rates in the world. It's just advanced and stable enough to be able to measure its rates. And so a place like Iraq or Syria or Lebanon, I mean, people there could smoke even more, but there just isn't the kind of research being done to document it. This is a glimpse of the future for many places, particularly African countries, where economies are growing enough now that people have enough disposable income to actually spend money on cigarettes. They say that these have become and will become the new battlegrounds in the fight between public health groups and big tobacco.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was The Guardian's international correspondent, Michael Safi. We went to tobacco companies about this episode. They suggested that the companies had been invited to relevant standard meetings by Jordan's Chamber of Industry, of which they are a part, to provide professional and technical support about smoke-free products. Philip Morris International said that their interactions with government officials in Jordan complied with all applicable laws, as well as higher international standards. They said, in any democratic society, the central objective of regulatory policy can only be achieved with full participation of those concerned. They argued that the treaties mentioned in this piece recommend that countries protect policies from commercial and other vested interests and ensure transparency, but do not ban interactions. British American Tobacco said that they believe that regulators have the right to hear all sides of any debate when they are developing policies, adding, "We believe that our experience and expertise can provide valuable insights and practical knowledge to governments and policymakers that can help in developing robust and evidence-based policies for our industry that deliver on the intended policy aims." Japan Tobacco International made the same argument about the relationships between business and government and said the tobacco sector is highly regulated and monitored by the government in Jordan and that they obeyed all regulations and policies. They added, JTI does not interfere or influence any health-related policies and regulation formation. The policies go through the official process for review, consultation and approval by the parliament. They also said that their corporate social responsibility programs did not conduct any tobacco-related activities with minors. A Jordanian government source authorised to comment said tobacco companies operate in Jordan according to commercial and health standards observed by the Ministry of Trade and Industry and do not receive any special treatment compared to other sectors. They also drew attention to anti-smoking campaigns and said the Prime Minister had formed a national committee to combat smoking. That's it for today. My thanks to Michael Safi and all those he interviewed. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.